It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The startling number of victims from the opioid crisis continues to grow. We'll take a look at a new way to measure just how widespread the crisis is and who these problems are likely to hit next. Plus, it's marathon weekend in Pittsburgh. Meet a handful of the thousands it takes to pull off Pittsburgh's biggest party. But first, it's been 2 years in the making. The process still isn't over. Catholics in the six-county Pittsburgh diocese anxiously awaited the decisions announced last weekend by Bishop David Zubik about consolidations of their parishes and new assignments for their pastors. We're going to talk about what this all means for hundreds of thousands of Catholics in the region and whether such mergers are a nationwide issue with Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Natasha, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
And also in studio is freelance writer Mark Kramer, who reported on this issue for Public Source. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
And your comments and questions are invited. Email them to confluence@wesa.fm or tweet them and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, a few key details, folks. To begin with, 188 parishes across six counties merging into 57 parish groupings, most of them with multiple worship sites. At this time, no facilities will close, according to the bishop. So let's start with, what reasons has the bishop given from day one of the process to this major consolidation?
Well, he said that for one thing, we have to take a really hard look, realistic look at the changing demographics and shifting needs of the region. The diocese spans about six counties, and there's been a lot of population shifts and changes since the last major restructuring, which happened in the early 90s. And some of the sobering statistics that they're up against include things like, since 2000, mass attendance has plummeted by more than 40%. Sacramental participation in things like marriage, baptisms, et cetera, has dropped by 50%. And so there, and not only that, there's a lot of these old buildings, ethnic churches, things that, you know, there used to be a day, a time when we'd have a German, Polish, and Irish Catholic church maybe on the same street. And our communities just can't sustain that and doesn't really meet with what they're looking for today anyway. So they're trying to, and on top of that, they're dealing with other issues like a priest shortage. It's really things like that. They're trying to reallocate resources to meet the current needs.
Mark?
Yeah, I would just sort of affirm that the lack of resources, lack of attendance at masses, and that demographic shift. And speaking with the bishop, he really pointed to kind of Rust Belt shifts. Countrywide, you see movement from this region of the country to the south, to the west, and emphasizing that in addition to what Natasha just said.
Yeah, I mean, I used the figure hundreds of thousands. Yeah. Those are the number that are registered. They're registered to parishes. But the actual, those, shall we say, active Catholics who are there, you know, week in and week out, is much, much lower than that. And that's what the issue is. Well, we asked the bishop if this was just a Pittsburgh diocese issue, whether it was dioceses across the country, whether it was other Christian faiths or other faiths. Let's have a listen.
My partners from the various Protestant denominations will say the same thing. We're experiencing the same kind of decline. My Jewish sisters and brothers are saying the very same thing, so it's across the board.
It's across the board, according to the bishop. So it's a challenging problem for all about it. Natasha, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I would say, and it's not even necessarily just, it's not just the Catholic or even Christian religions. All religious institutions are up against a broader trend of more and more Americans turning away from religion. Nearly a quarter of U.S. adults call themselves spiritual but not religious. And, you know, don't necessarily attend church service regularly, even though they may believe in God. Millennials are among the least religious of this group, citing things like a distrust in religious institutions, too many Christians doing unchristian things, and finding community through other ways. So that's part of the problem that, or part of the challenge that all religious institutions are up against right now.
Peter Smith is religion reporter, writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Peter, what's your take on what the bishop said? This is cutting across a variety of faiths. It's not just a Pittsburgh Catholic diocese issue about declining attendance in churches and synagogues.
his goal, what he has said, is that this is to kind of get into fighting trim so that they churches can live within their means and then start doing what, you know, evangelism, mission. That's why he calls the project On Mission for the Church Alive, that that basically they need to do what Catholics are not all that used to doing, especially at the lay level, which is evangelizing.
And in the process of restructuring, something that the bishop has emphasized, and also Father Samuel Esposito, who's overseeing the implementation of On Mission, really emphasized that they're focusing then on relationship. Yeah, there are these pressures that are causing the lessening of attendance at masses, but okay, in dealing with that, they're focusing on bringing churches together and saying, how can we focus on our mission, focus on relationship, rejig what's going on, and create a new identity through those relationships.
Mark, I want to get you to be more specific on relationship. Sure. Relationship parish to parish, relationship with registered Catholics who might not regularly attend. What specific relationship?
Parish to parish, individuals within those parishes. The bishop points to just parishioners coming together around festivals, around fish fries, and then through that process kind of having an organic restructuring in a sense, because through that you decide who you are as a parish.
Yeah, and when he talks about increasing vibrancy, the bishop also says we need better homilies. We want to give priests more time to work on their homilies so they can make more of an impact when people show up on Sunday. We want to get people excited about going to church again. We want to re-engage youth maybe through more service projects, or, you know, maybe project-based learning instead of the traditional way we've always done religious education. One of the challenges will be as this process moves forward, even though all these things sound great, ultimately, church buildings are going to have to close. And they're not saying the exact number yet, but you know, they form these parish groupings, and when you talk to each person within these groupings, no one thinks their church is going to close necessarily, and mm-hmm. they're really hopeful that doesn't happen. But in a year and a half, that's probably when some of the tensions are going to come. You know, even though they've been doing fish fries and we like our neighbors, no one wants to lose their church building where they've had, you know, maybe 100 years worth of generations of people getting baptized and married and buried.
I want to get to the buildings, because people develop attachments, investments. They invest their time, their energy, even their finances. But also want to talk about the individuals. People make connections with their pastors, with their deacons. The new assignments begin October 15th, right, Peter?
Yes.
So a majority of the priests are being reassigned?
Yeah, when the announcements were made over this past weekend, I mean, everybody knew parish consolidation was coming, so there were no big surprises there, but what there were surprises about were about the assignments of their priests. And those that were losing priests that they liked, there was a lot of emotion, a lot of sadness, some tears. I was at one church that was keeping its priest, and there were a lot, and they like him a lot. There were a lot of sighs of relief.
Yes, and there were others. I know you did a story, and I think the headline was, you know, okay with the change, but, you know, the shifting was quite emotional.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And again, as Natasha said, the mergers themselves, that in itself, you know, people are used to, but they are waiting for the other shoe to drop. And a lot of the decision-making on which churches to close is, at least to some extent, is being delegated to the parishes. It would still have to be up to the bishop. But he is saying to each parish, you know, figure out what are your means that you can live with, and that includes how many buildings you can keep open. So they themselves may have to begin to make some of those painful decisions of, you know, closing the church where they themselves may have been baptized or married.
Natasha, I believe you reported almost 80% of the priests are being
reassigned. Yes, 160 of 200. And so that's what, even the bishop wasn't, when he first announced that, the press conference wasn't aware it was quite that high. He thought it was roughly half, and then they corrected that a little later. So it is a majority of priests. Every priest has a technical new assignment because they're part of this new parish grouping, but 80% will be at a different location than they are now starting October. That's probably what's the first thing, as Peter said, that's going to really start affecting people. One thing, part of what I understand is why that's had to happen, why, you know, such a large percentage have been transferred, is they are also trying to juggle things like not only each priest's special skills, but their ages. A lot of priests are still set to retire, dwindling quickly. They don't want to leave a parish grouping, you know, without a priest pastor. So they're trying to really be strategic about how to best allocate the resources under these new structures.
In any of your reporting on that regarding priests, whether they're being reassigned or not, and the reasons for it. Has the bishop said, yeah, it's going to be painful. He mentioned that it could be painful for some people, the reassignments. But, you know, change can be difficult for people. And did he address the idea of that, that change can be? So why not keep something that's familiar, your pastor, to help with the rest of the transition?
I think he's basically just explained that we just can't afford to just pretend, you know, keep things as they are and stay with the status quo if we really want to survive and thrive in the long term. So he says, yes, this is going to be painful, but we're going to have to make these adjustments. And even though all of these reassignments are happening now, one of the priests I talked to who is being reassigned from the North Hills to Swissville Braddock area, he's been reassigned already 4 times in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So they're already having priests transfer, rove, you know, drive around to multiple parishes. So if anything, I think they're hoping this will be a more permanent structure for people to hopefully build relationships and get used to.
Mm-hmm. Mark, you've been focusing on the Hilltop communities in the South Side. They've gone through this merger consolidation process before, not all that long ago. Yeah. Did you talk much about assignment of priests in addition to the actual consolidation?
In the Hilltop neighborhoods and South Side Slopes, which are now being merged. At one point, there were 15 parishes operating.
15.
And that's back in the day when there were 5-6 masses at a parish on a given weekend. That's now becoming one parish. Before this, it was just a couple of parishes. But there's basically multiple iterations of mergers that are now leading into that one. And so over a series of decades, you've got, I think, probably some fatigue and mixed experiences, feelings about that. I think a sense of resignation among some people that says, yeah, I see the finances, I see the numbers, this has to happen. But also some loss, some real grief and loss of sense of that identity in their parish that used to be very much of a neighborhood parish, but is no longer. They're just no longer defined by geography. They're going to have to find a new sense of definition because they're no longer that neighborhood it used to be.
And on top of all those neighborhood parishes, each of those neighborhoods had their own schools and in many cases even their own high schools. So they were very much community centers where people had oriented their lives around, and that's now a bygone era.
And that's more of a long-term concern is when a church goes dark, just as a school mm-hmm. does, it has deep impacts on the community, even if you're not Catholic. You know, an area like Allentown that's trying to revitalize, new shops are popping up, and then their big, you know, their church, it's like the anchor of their skyline, shuts down, and that's a loss. It's a real loss for everybody.
Natasha and Peter, I know that you were reporting over the weekend, talking to people. What was the mood in general? And number two, what was the general essence of the message the pastors were giving to their parishioners?
The priest I talked to said they were, in addition to reading a letter the bishop prepared as well as published in the Pittsburgh Catholic and the bulletins, they wanted to just reassure people, hey, first of all, no churches are closing now. None of this is happening now, and you're still going to have more time to give input, which the bishop also emphasized. He will make the final decisions, but he wants to give time for these new pastoral teams to, you know, get to know each other, get to know their communities, get to know their people, and figure things out. So they're trying to, you know, they don't want people to get too worried right now. They want them to participate moving forward. But there's obviously some sadness, especially for priests that have been long ingrained in these communities, are having to say goodbye to.
Peter?
The dominant tone, I would say, was an effort to give reassurance, to say, you know, yes, these are big changes. They're going to be painful changes in some cases. One priest was basically announcing he was being reassigned, and he teared up as well, and as did the parishioners. And so, you know, it varied a little bit depending on the audience, but I'd say the dominant effort was an attempt to reassure and encourage that this is a pruning in order to grow later.
Okay. It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the announced consolidations of many parishes, 188 parishes in the Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese to 57 parish groupings. And we're going to talk about the process because this isn't the end. This is really going to take course over a few years, actually. I want to talk about another reason. We just touched upon briefly the economics of doing this. So we have, yes, fewer Catholics actually attending Mass, fewer people attending Mass, but also We talked very briefly about the age of some of these buildings and the massive upkeep. Let's start with you, Mark.
Yeah, and just to start with one important distinction, the difference between a parish and a church right. building.
Church building.
And then the difference between a church building and a building. You know, so there's a whole process entailed that says this is a sacred edifice used for certain purposes.
Because there can be multiple buildings yep. on a church on a parish campus, right. let's put it that way.
Yeah, so it actually gets kind of complicated. What do you do with that empty church then? And then when you have all of these empty churches, you know, how do you put those on the market? At the end of the day, from outside the church's point of view, it's a piece of real estate, sure, with some beautiful architectural value, but what value does it have on the market to a neighborhood? So it does get pretty complicated.
Who owns these church buildings? Does the diocese own the buildings? Do the individual parishes own the buildings and therefore they can do, whenever a building is closed, what can be done with it?
My understanding is that it's with the parish itself. And so, for example, St. Mary of the Mount owns St. John Vianney Church in Allentown that they inherited through a previous merger. And so they've been in discussion about, well, what do we do with this? And it's actually been a source of conflict that's even gone to the Vatican because it's been appealed. The bishop's decision to close it has been appealed by a society, the St. George Preservation Society. And so, but that's St. Mary of the Mount's building to deal with because of a previous merger.
And that's one question to me. When they, you know, a year from now, when they start to buildings start to close down, there could be more groups that you know protest these closures all the way to the Vatican. We've seen them happen in pockets in this region, including St. John Vianney, where you know their historical preservation societies or someone steps up and says, "Hey, what if we raise the money to pay the bills for the boiler, or do this, or we want to save our church?" And there have been some criticism, you know, broader nationally about a concern about too many Catholic churches turning into these mega churches and losing their local community feel. Now, being from the West Coast, I'll tell you, like from Arizona, California, there's a lot of, you know, people are much more spread out. There's a lot of new churches growing up. I was in a church in a school cafeteria for years. So it's also, I think, there's a different sense of identity here in Pennsylvania where we have these beautiful churches that have been here such deep-rooted history versus other parts of the country. It might not be so hard to let go of, you know, certain facilities.
Peter, I believe the bishop, when he made his announcement, said that decisions on the buildings will come after the groupings begin to come together, and once that the pastor and the leaders of that parish sort of make their own decision, I should say, make their own recommendation to him what to do with the facilities. Is that how it's going to work or supposed to work?
Yes, that's how it is.
Okay, so we're still talking a little ways down the line about actual buildings, what's going to happen to them.
Correct.
Let's talk about the parishes themselves. How were they grouped together? Now, obviously, you have to be near one another, or at least in proximity to one another. But were there any other factors made in decisions, ethnic, cultural factors, financial factors of the communities themselves?
Yes. Yeah, so the bishop said they've tried not to group churches of either extreme dire financial straits or extreme affluence. Geography was a huge concern. In fact, some of the latest parish groupings, they changed, like they broke up a group of six in the North Hills down to two separate ones, because even though they might not be that much distance on a map, there's things like hills or bridges or places where the people themselves feel more disconnected from certain communities. So they did try to take that into account. And more broadly than that, they grouped all of these parish groupings into three categories. Category A being the ones who are in the most financial trouble and are going to have to complete their merger process by 2020. The churches, groupings that are a little bit better off may have up to, until 5 years to complete their plans. It is worth noting, across the six-county diocese, for years now, more than half of parishes have been losing money.
Losing money. They can't keep up with their budget.
And debt is climbing, meanwhile, along with repair bills, et cetera.
Is that mostly due to the physical plant, do you know? Do we know if that's due to the physical plant of, you know, the buildings, the upkeep?
I think that's a big part of it, but I think it's also, like you said, you know, half of attendance is down. You have half as many people are even donating money on Sundays. So it's a combination of all those things colliding.
So you mentioned that not to try to get lumped together either poor churches, if you would, parishes, and more affluent parishes. But let's face it, in some communities that are nearby each other, you know, nearby, I'll say the North Hills, for example, there can be more affluent communities there, and so their parishes are close anyway, and I know that some of them are lumped together, Peter.
I mean, there are different criteria. That is one of the goals. One of the kind of ideals is to put parishes together of different means, but also geography has to play a role as well. And, you know, and also some of the timeless things like trying to get Pittsburghers to cross a river or, you know,
Oh, that old problem.
Yes, that comes into play as well.
Okay, we have just about a minute and a half left, and I want to get each of your takes on what you'll be doing following this story, this issue, in the months ahead and even in the years ahead. Mark, what interests you in pursuing?
Well, I think actually on that last point, like I said, I've been looking at the Hilltop neighborhoods. If I think about the demographics in a neighborhood like Knoxville, which is now part of the parish that includes St. Mary of the Mount, that is part of Mount Washington. Those are very different demographics. I'm really interested in the differences racially, culturally, that are going to be part of these mergers. I think those are real and need to be encountered. Looking forward to hearing about how parishioners feel about those differences.
All right. Natasha, do you have any stories coming up in the very near future?
Yeah.
And in the long term, what are you looking at?
You know, the bishop keeps talking and the diocese keep talking about trying to increase the vibrancy in the church. So I want to dig into what does that really mean? What are the efforts happening to make that happen? They're ranging from reengaging youth to training in areas where there's fast-growing Hispanic populations. They're training priests in Hispanic language and culture. They hired a new social media coordinator. They're trying to get all the, you know. So I'll be interested to trying to really spell out what this means and what's being done to actually increase attendance at the church, and is it working?
And very briefly, Peter, please.
I'll be looking at the same, and also some of the churches that are, how are some of the difficult decisions going to be made as far as churches that have a very strong ethnic history or aesthetic or cultural history?
Peter Smith is religion reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Natasha Lindstrom is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And Mark Kramer is a freelance writer. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Pittsburgh has played host to its share of celebrities, but it's not often that one involved in an ongoing White House scandal draws weekday crowds to one of its strip clubs. Adult film star Stormy Daniels performed 4 shows at Blush in downtown Pittsburgh this week. It was part of her Make America Horny Again tour. She also filed a defamation lawsuit against President Donald Trump. Joining us to talk about her 2-night engagement and the political maelstrom behind it is reporter Colin Deppen with the online news organization The Incline. Colin, great to have you back.
Hi, Megan.
So the owner of Blush, Albert Bortz, told reporters that about 200 people came out for her show Wednesday night. That's not quite capacity, but it's a solid draw for the middle of the week. You were there too, outside and inside. What did you see?
To sum it up in a word, I would describe it as somewhat carnival-esque. Full disclosure, I don't have a ton of experience with strip clubs, but I will say this seemed busy for a Wednesday night, prime time, and it was lively, as you might expect. This is both a political moment, but also a pop culture moment, and plenty of the people there were ready to embrace both ends of the spectrum on this particular appearance Wednesday night at Blush.
And you said they didn't all arrive all at once.
No. Most came, when I entered maybe an hour and a half before Daniels took the stage, and there was a lot more room at that point. And by the time she took the stage at about 10:30 p.m. on Wednesday, it was standing room only.
Stormy Daniels has been performing in the adult film industry for years, but people really only know her name now, partially because she's been talking about an alleged affair she had with Trump in 2006. She says she received $130,000 in return for a non-disclosure agreement that was just before the 2016 election. He has since acknowledged, this week in fact, that his money actually covered that NDA. How much of that was in the ether Wednesday night?
For the reporters on hand, it was certainly in the ether. As we were sitting there watching Daniels, or it may have been minutes before she took the stage, we all received the push notification about Rudy Giuliani's interview. I believe it was on the Fox Network on Wednesday night, in which he acknowledged that Trump had reimbursed Cohen for that $130,000 payment shortly before the election.
Back up just a second. That's former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. He's Trump's new personal attorney. He replaced Michael Cohen, who initially said he paid Stormy Daniels with his own money. Cohen is still under investigation, and his offices were recently raided by the FBI.
Yeah. As far as everyone else in the crowd, I imagine it took most of them a bit longer to find out. But again, the politics were, for at least some of the audience, inseparable from all of this. There were folks with MAGA hats. One guy was carrying a stack of them in what appeared to be a Walmart bag.
That's Make America Great Again.
That is Make America Great Again hats. His plan was to have Stormy Daniels sign them, cross out the great, replace it with horny, and then he was going to go online and flip these. Or other folks had copies of In Touch magazine profiles on Daniels, and on and on and on. And everyone that we talked to certainly was aware of the political backstory here, even if some were somewhat less interested than others.
And you wrote that her four-song act wasn't especially political in and of itself, and she denied all interview requests through Blush. Did she talk at all? Did she interact with the people that were there?
She had a meet and greet. After her performance, there was a meet and greet, a long line. That line snaked down the stairs that lead from the first floor to the balcony that overlooks the stage. So she had some one-on-one encounters, but as for any formal interviews with the press, no, I'm not aware of any.
How forthcoming were the people that you talked to who were there for the entertainment value?
This is an interesting question because, I mean, you're at a strip club. Not everybody wants to broadcast their attendance at a strip club for a variety of reasons. But they were very forthcoming. Certainly nobody was shy about discussing all of the backstory and the context and the backdrop here. But a lot of them wanted their names withheld. A lot of people were comfortable talking only when, I agreed not to identify them. Outside, though, there were some folks that were more than willing to be identified. So it was a bit of a mix as far as that's concerned.
Was there any presence that was maybe pro or anti-Trump?
Not that I observed personally. I saw one gentleman in the men's room with a Make America Great Again shirt. I don't know if that was ironic or not, but it's nothing outside. I didn't see any protesters outside. In fact, a lot of the folks I talked to outside were passing by, and more than I expected, they said they were unfamiliar with the name Stormy Daniels, which surprised me.
I was about to say, I mean, are these regular patrons, big fans of hers? Were they just there for the spectacle?
I would split this crowd into three sections: club regulars, semi-regulars, and people, first-timers who came just for the spectacle of it all.
Going into this assignment, how did you and the Incline decide to cover it, and ultimately what to include in the story?
We went back and forth on this. This is not a typical assignment for a news reporter, so we definitely had some discussions beforehand. Ultimately, though, the decision was made that we really had to go in from a storytelling standpoint. The story was all inside the club. You had to be there, and we had to see it firsthand and convey some of that to the readers.
Colin, I got to ask, the Incline staff is predominantly female. Did you volunteer for this one?
I did not. I'm gonna have to, full disclosure, out all of them that they were very insistent that I do this, and I fought and fought and fought.
Any feedback from readers so far?
No. I mean, we've certainly had some feedback from readers on Twitter, but no formal emails saying I have an issue with this coverage. We've gotten those on other pieces involving Trump, but not this particular one.
Colin Deppen is a reporter for The Incline. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Megan.
Coming up, Keeley Ashbaugh is in many ways a typical 8-year-old, full of energy and adoration for those she loves. But she's also indicative of a fight raging across Appalachia and a child welfare system ill-equipped to meet her needs. That's coming up when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The 150-year-old Frick House is sinking. Officials who run the museum say years of wear and tear on the home's foundation has caused it to sink half an inch. An $800,000 project is underway to repair it. And developers of a downtown building are relocating a pair of peregrine falcons nesting in it. They say the birds have become more and more aggressive and got permission from wildlife officials to move it. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 14 states saw a decline in opioid fatal overdoses last year. Not Pennsylvania. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, several states experienced big increases: Delaware, Florida, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, most likely due to fentanyl being mixed in with the opioids. Just how widespread is the problem? Well, you can measure it in overdoses, fatalities, arrests, but some cities are trying a different approach to understand the crisis. And we're going to talk a bit about that with Linda Poon, a reporter for City Lab. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You report about some of the experimental solutions to get a better grasp of the extent of the crisis, from real-time maps to sewer robots. Let's start with the maps. So what are cities doing, and how do they think this might help?
So one of the big things is they're actually looking at sort of emergency response rather than going through hospital records. So one HITA, which is actually a part of a federal program, is working with cities like Baltimore to sort of in real time record what response, police response and EMT response to what may be opioid related overdoses. And that way they can better monitor whether any spikes in real time. So rather than waiting for sort of medical records to come back, they can monitor, here is a police officer actually responding right now to a possible overdose case. And that will give them sort of a better measure in some ways.
Is it to deploy their forces, deploy their services so they can respond more quickly? Is that the idea?
So it's more of just data gathering, right? Mm-hmm. So they want a better idea of when these spikes are happening and how these illicit drugs are traveling through cities within the city. So they're actually, in terms of deploying better care, the 911 system is sort of taking care of that. But in terms of understanding, these are spikes and that we need to address this area as soon as possible, this is what some of the sort of mapping projects are about.
Okay. I mentioned in introducing you sewer robots. You start your report with a city that maybe we might not think about when it comes to the opioid crisis, Cary, North Carolina. What led you there?
Yeah, so I was looking at sort of Bloomberg's mayor challenges, some of the winners, and Cary immediately stood out to me because just the word sewage usually just kind of stands out to a city urban reporter. So Cary's interesting in that it doesn't have quite the sort of overdose crisis that some of other North Carolina cities have, which means they can be more proactive about catching trends and stuff. So what they're doing is they're partnering with a MIT affiliate company called BioBots, and they're sending these devices into the sewage, basically collecting waste samples, molecules, waste samples. And the idea is that these molecules will be sent back to a lab to get analyzed. And what they're looking for is metabolites, which are what gets flushed out of your system when you consume opioids. And that will sort of tell them sort of, the consumption of opioids.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, what do they hope to get from that? So they determine consumption, or at least the total consumption. What do they hope to use that data with or for?
Yeah, so it's hard to tell, what are some of the other nuances. So with this new data on consumption, they're planning to combine it with other data. So census data, data about parks, and sort of get a geographic map visual of, where are these consumptions happening. And that way they can, using census data, they can sort of, suss out some of the demographic trends. So who are the ones that are most affected? Are they people of a certain age group, certain race group? Right. Are they people who live near parks? Are they people who, live closer to the city or farther out to the city? So these little nuances that breaks down, more details about who is being affected rather than a city is being affected in general.
Well, we're very interested in seeing how this research turns out. Linda Poon's a reporter for City Lab. Thank you so much, Linda, for joining us.
Thank you.
Experts say thousands of Pittsburghers have suffered ill effects, made life or death choices, and paid the ultimate price in the ongoing effort to kick the habit and keep opioids out of their lives. And joining us in studio now to talk about how opioids are affecting the children of those addicted here in Pittsburgh, Post-Gazette journalists Rich Lord and Stephanie Strasberg. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it, Kevin.
Rich, tell us about the focus of your latest piece, 8-year-old Keely Ashbaugh.
Yeah, we'd spent a lot of time last year, particularly in the hardest hit Pittsburgh neighborhoods, looking at the folks who are in addiction, who typically tend to be 25 to 45 years old. And then we started noticing, hey, a lot of these folks have kids, and there's a whole nother generation coming up which is affected by this opioid crisis in a different way. Not only the kids, but also in many cases the parents of the users, because they're the ones typically taking care of the kids. So we decided to dedicate a lot of time this year to understanding how this plays out across generations, how it affects the kids and also the grandparents of the folks who are most in addiction.
Okay, Stephanie, much of this is made throughout the writing of the piece and to capture Keely's physicality, her energy, her joy. You know, kids can be shy, but yet your images suggest an intimacy, like a guest looking down from an adult's height, if you would. How did you go about that? How did you approach that?
Oh, we were really lucky because Keely's family was open to collaborating with us, having us in. They believed in the importance of sharing this story, and that was really, really a gift. Keely and her sisters, there's four little girls total that live in their house, were all really excited about having a camera around, and it was less them being shy and more me being boring enough at a certain point for them to kind of forget about me and let me record their daily routine as they go through it.
So after they ignored you, you got better images or what?
Yeah, I think there's a point where you go
or
in
accepted
and
you maybe
yeah,
that you're there.
You interact with them and build that trust and get them comfortable with you and then slowly start to fade in the background and let their daily life unfold so that we can share it with other people.
Mm-hmm. You both note several details in the telling of their story, how the kids aren't allowed inside anyone else's home in the neighborhood because stamp bags were found or the ongoing renovation efforts in the home, including a stair railing made of what Keely's father, TJ, could find outside. This sort of creates a stark picture, but they also seem really dedicated to each other and to recovery.
They really are, and that starts with the matriarch of the family, Danielle, who had an prescription opioid problem about 10 years ago and recovered from it. She lost one of her sons, Ricky, to an overdose on Halloween. Another son, TJ, who is Keely's father, is in recovery, and Keely's mother is out in parts unknown, still struggling with addiction. So this family has seen the effects and has really coalesced and is almost like circling the wagons around the little girls trying to protect them from this.
Stephanie, did color sort of play a factor in how your eye sort of, you know, roamed around the family, looked at the family? It seems like almost every image features shall we say, some pink. They do have four little girls running around.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that. Kate, Keely's stepmother and the mother of the other three little girls that live with her, loves leopard print and loves pink and dresses her girls accordingly. So that was just a personality trait of them. And I think one of the things that made this story especially interesting for me as a visual person was the contrast of TJ, this young man who's in recovery and fighting the hard fight, who lived a past life that was really, really tough, in and out of jail, dealing drugs, stuff like that. And now he's staying home as part of his recovery and raising these four little girls. And there's something really endearing about seeing a man that tough doing ponytails and pigtails and cooking dinner. You know, it's a special dynamic.
Obviously, individuals can personalize the story. There's numbers, and sometimes numbers and facts can be cold, but individuals can really tell the story. I want to ask you both, the McLean-Ashbaugh family is the example, but really, how prevalent is this multi-generational fight against opioids?
We're seeing in every county in the region and in the state as a whole, double-digit increases in the number of kids who've had to go to foster homes, driven almost entirely by the opioid epidemic. We're seeing roughly 90,000 kids living with their grandparents in this state. Again, that's that number's gone up dramatically, and that's driven almost entirely by the opioid epidemic, too. So they are they're a very representative family. They're not in any way an anomaly anymore.
Mm-hmm. Part two in this two-part series dives deeper into how the problem, the opioid problem, is affecting the child welfare system. What did you find there, Stephanie, Rich?
Well, what we found is, as I mentioned before, very meaningful increases in the stresses on that system and also responses to that, too. For instance, in Allegheny County, families and particularly parents who are in addiction have a hard time getting to treatment. Allegheny County is going to bring the treatment to the home, and pretty soon they're going to open up a whole family rehab center where parents and kids can go together to get drug treatment, inpatient drug treatment.
Stephanie? I wanted to ask you and Rich about this series. And this isn't your first venture into chronicling how opioids have hit and devastated the Pittsburgh region. So what have you learned about the challenges and even maybe the joys of reporting on folks with this problem? Start with you, Stephanie.
I think a lot of the joy is in the relationships that we get to build with the people that we tell stories about. And tomorrow, for example, I'm heading out to Greensburg to go take prom photos for Tanyelle, who's one of the young women who lost her mom. And we chronicled that in our story, Life and Death on Santron Avenue. She's moving on as a young woman. This is a big stage in her life. Going to prom is a certain coming of age thing. And that I've, you know, been able to maintain a relationship with her and see her grow past this tragedy and see her grow through this tragedy is something really rewarding, not only as a journalist, but as a person.
Mm-hmm. And Rich, what have you learned about this whole issue that this region, this country is dealing with?
I think a lot of people come into any engagement with heroin users thinking they're going to be all about one thing. They're all about getting their drugs. That's all it is. But they're actually, oftentimes in our experience, very complicated and thoughtful people who are incredibly knowledgeable about what's going on in their brain, about the nature of their addictions, and have very complicated lives, typically complicated by the problems that the drug creates. And it's been fascinating to watch them kind of fight through the bureaucracies, courts, insurance, treatment, everything that they have to deal with.
We've learned what Stephanie's going to be doing this weekend, that photo assignment and the prom. Still anything on your plate or questions that you still want to answer, address, explore about this? We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, lots on our plate, but I don't want to say too much about it till I get it written. So keep in touch.
All right. Not even a question you want answered? Not going to tease us a little bit?
Well, I would like to learn more and will learn more about how folks who are in recovery are housed and how they can get employment. So look out for that soon.
All right. Thank you both so much. Stephanie Strasburg is multimedia journalist with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Rich Lord is an investigative reporter for the PG. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Kevin.
Coming up, we're going to be on the streets of Pittsburgh, or at least thousands of people will this weekend. It's marathon weekend. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kathleen Davis with the Pittsburgh Almanac. In this week in history, journalist Nellie Bly, famous for her trip around the world in 72 days, is born in Burrell Township in 1864. In 1882, the Pirates, back then the Pittsburgh Alleghenies, play and win their first major league game. And in 2009, UPMC surgeons perform the first double hand transplant in the U.S. That's this week in Pittsburgh history for May 4th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As many as 40,000 participants are expected downtown this weekend for one of the biggest parties of the year. That's right. Marathon Day is almost upon us, plus the half marathon, marathon relay, kids events. Organizers are calling this the 10th annual Pittsburgh event, although technically a misnomer. We're going to talk about why and what it looks like today with Gretchen McKay, reporter and runner for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the program, Gretchen.
Well, thanks for asking me, Kevin.
All right, Gretchen, a little background first. Pittsburgh Marathon, in its original iteration, was born in 1985. It was a big deal back then. It actually served as the U.S. Olympic trials for men and women for the 1988 and the 2000 Summer Olympics. Then a big sponsor pulled out. The city felt on hard times at that point.
That's right, and it sort of went bust, and Pittsburgh had no marathon.
So 26.2 miles, 13.1 for the half marathon, thousands and thousands running through dozens of city neighborhoods and thousands more along the route cheering for them all. You want to put faces and voices and stories to those numbers. As a reporter, how did you pick the subjects for your profiles? What were you looking for?
Well, we wanted to show the people who were involved in getting the marathon back up and running in 2009, as well as the people who come out and volunteer for the race. And we also wanted to put a face on the people who actually are participating, both the elite athletes and just the regular everyday runners who do what is really one of the most exciting running events in Pittsburgh of the year.
And as you mentioned, that rebooted the marathon in 2009.
In 2009.
So hence the 10th of
That's this iteration.
Okay. So was Michelle Fetting an obvious choice for one of these profiles since she was sort of either a or even the moving force to reviving the marathon?
She was. There would be no Pittsburgh Marathon if it wasn't for Michelle Fetting, because she really got the ball rolling. What had happened was she had been at a marathon. Her husband was running in Cleveland, the Flying Pig, and it sort of struck her that Pittsburgh did not have one of these races, and you really can't be a major city without a major marathon. At least she thought that, being a runner. So when she came back, she just started making some calls to city officials saying, you know, we've got to get this race back up and running. So she was really sort of tireless in her pursuit of getting people behind her. And she was also the person who reached out to Dick's to get the major sponsorship, because, of course, it costs a lot of money to get a race.
You report during this time she was also tackling another challenge, a personal challenge, a physical challenge.
That's right. After she sort of got things going, she discovered that she had cancer, and she was quite ill and ended up with a bone marrow transplant. But, you know, what's great about Michelle, and if you read the story, which was the first in a series of 10 stories we did in the Post-Gazette, you can just see her grit and her determination to keep plugging away at it. She's probably one of the most fierce people I've ever met. And I've met a lot of runners, and runners are pretty amazing people. But boy, she just didn't give up even when she was at her sickest.
Okay. Now, Michelle turned to Patrice Matamoros, the race director, who's been the director of all 10 of these races since it resumed in 09.
That's,
why so?
Well, it's funny because she just happened to be somebody she knew from her kids' elementary school. Patrice was running a program for kids, and she just sort of said, hey, do you want to be the race director? And Patrice had been an elite runner when she was in college, so it's not like she came in it with, right, you know, no skill set. But and she had gone on to get a business degree, and she is another amazing story because, again, it takes a lot of organization and people skills to get a race going. And she had such a great business degree or background to her. And so she was able to go out and get all the, you know, permitting and the officials and just everything that they needed to get the race back up.
An injury actually cut short Patrice's running in college.
That's right.
She sort of put that same energy into organize and running the event.
She did. And what I love about this story is there's so many strong women that are involved with the marathon. So
unusual is that for a race director to be a woman for a major event?
There are more today, I understand, but when, you know, back when the old marathon, as we're going to call it, was running in Pittsburgh, it was pretty rare for a woman to be in such a, as a race director, because it's a man's world, sports.
Okay. Were there any other stories among the marathon's command staff that sort of left an impression on you?
Through the command, well, Gary Brown is the course director. He's the one who's responsible just for getting everything, you know, not just developing the course, which has changed many times over the past 10 years. This actually will be the only the first time they're going to have the same course 2 years in a row because Pittsburgh, you know, has so much construction going on all the time. But he's got to, you know, get all the emergency personnel in line, the ambulances, the porta potties, just getting them placed. So it's a huge undertaking as well.
Does he have to measure it actually too?
The measure the course?
Yes.
Yeah. They, and I mean, because it has to be verified. So I think he told me that they run it twice. But it's, yeah, because people, this is a Boston qualifier. So you really have to have the distance absolutely correct.
And if you want to hear how Gary and his crew measure the course, you can check that out at WESA.fm. Okay, so the marathon made a comeback in 2009. Let's talk about a personal comeback. Jeff Whitmore, the opening line of your story about him, quote, "Here's what Jeff Whitmore remembers about the 2015 Pittsburgh Marathon. Nothing," end quote. Why?
Well, because he was coming down the Boulevard of the Allies towards the finish, and about 100 yards out, he went into cardiac arrest and basically just dropped to the pavement. And it was very lucky that there just happened to be a doctor just on the course that came over and was able to start CPR until the EMS got there and were able to shock him back. So he was gone for about a minute. He woke up several days later in the hospital, in the, you know, cardiac unit. Right. So
he's back running. Why is he running here in Pittsburgh, the scene of a near-death experience?
Well, he came back actually the year after and did a race. And I think what you'll find when you read these stories in the Post-Gazette is just runners have a certain, I don't know, my husband thinks we're all crazy. I think we're just very strong and determined people. And I think he came back because he didn't want to let the course get the better of him. So he'll be the first to tell you he's not going to be as fast. He can't run as far. He's got a pacemaker in his chest. His doctor doesn't really want him to be doing this, but he's going to do it anyway.
Don't we all love comeback stories? You also profiled 45-year-old, I believe, right? She is, Mindy Zatola, who suffered a pulmonary embolism, not during a marathon, but while she was running one day. Doctors told her that she would never run again.
They told her that she's an elite athlete, so she is fast. And she actually is so fast that she qualified for the Olympic trials. Yes, and what happened was she was out running, and she felt like she had been shot. She actually went down, felt for blood, and was trying to figure out who in her neighborhood, she's out in Indiana, PA, would have shot her with a gun. What it was is that she had a pulmonary embolism and had blown out her lung, and she lost 30% of her function in the lung. And her doctor said, you know, you're not going to ever be even recreational runner again, let alone an elite athlete. But you know what? This is the perseverance and the grit and determination of runners. She was like, oh, yes, I am, and secretly started training on a treadmill at her YMCA, came back and ended up winning a local marathon. I think it was in Johnstown, and then came back to Pittsburgh and did super well. She's back.
All right. You also decided to talk to the oldest registered runners this year, 76-year-old Jerry Agin, among the men, and female runner, 75-year-old Cheryl Mahoney. Let's hear from Jerry.
My first marathon was the first ever Pittsburgh Marathon in 1985. I've missed a few since then, but I've run the majority of them. My times have gotten slower as I get older. I estimate about half an hour per decade as I age.
He thinks it's no big deal that he's that old and he's out there running marathons, which is kind of astounding. And also what's fun about Jerry is that he plays his bugle as he runs. So while the crowds are cheering him on, he's giving the love back.
And what keeps Cheryl running?
Cheryl is very different from Jerry. Jerry actually runs with the Hash House Harriers, and he trains. He tries to put in the miles every week. Cheryl, she told me she just walks in South Park where she lives during the week, and she just goes to races, and that's when she runs, which is, believe me, as a runner, that is not the normal way to do things. Usually you're really worried about cross training and putting in the distance and all that stuff, but she just shows up and runs.
Will you be out there this weekend?
I am signed up for the half marathon. That's the plan.
And what's your experience when you cross the finish line, though, when you run?
You know, there's such a blend of emotions because you're so happy it's over. And it's so exciting to just be a part of such a big event in Pittsburgh. You're a little bit sad because what you've been training for 3 or 4 months is done. You're relieved because now you get to take a break and maybe not work so hard for a couple weeks until you choose a race that you're going to start training for again.
Half marathoner and Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Gretchen McKay. Gretchen, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks a lot, Kevin. I appreciate it.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Research and production from Zakiya Majan. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.